This is an oral history interview with Harold Gene Paul, who goes by the name of Gene. And it is February 14th, 2006. Okay, first of all, could you tell me your full name and birth date and what brought you to Union County and approximately when?
Full name is Harold Gene Paul. I go by Gene.
Your birth date?
Birth date is October the 7th, 1940. So I just turned 65. What brought me to Union County? I was transferred here by the Forest Service. In the fall of 1981, I'd worked in Corvallis for about 12 years in Corvallis. And our entire research unit was transferred to Corvallis, or to LeGrand, in total.
Is that when the lab came into being here?
Has been here. This building that we're sitting in right now was built in 1968. Prior to that, it was in the SAC Annex. You know what the SAC?
Yes,
okay.
I do.
Okay, so they had, I think, like two or three people, lab, that held residence in the SAC Annex. And this place was built in 1968, which, when it was finished in 68, is not what it is right now. This bottom floor was essentially not finished. And in fact, some of the walls that you see here weren't even here then. This area over here where Jane and all those people have their desks, that was just a cupboard, and we had trailers we parked in there. So that was unfinished. So the lab was only accommodating maybe 8 or 10 people before we got here. And
so
there was 14 of us, I think, that were eligible to come over here at that time.
Okay. For the record, we're talking about the Forestry and Range Sciences Lab on Geckler Lane, which is a portion of the United States Forest Service.
It's part of the Pacific Northwest Forest and Range Experiment Station. That's the old name.
Right.
That's the one I know.
So this lab actually was a work in progress for a number of years after it opened.
Yes. I had a very reduced staff. I mean, from what we knew. When we came over, we more than doubled the staff.
I see. So. Okay, let's back up a bit then. You came to the Forest Service, you said, from Corvallis. And you said you'd been there about 11 years.
Yeah.
And then, so where did you start with the Forest Service before Corvallis?
Prairie City. I worked on the Prairie City Ranger District for 2 summers.
Then to Corvallis and then to LeGrand.
Yeah.
And so your career has been entirely in Oregon.
Inside Oregon.
Okay. And the majority of it in Union County.
Yes.
It looks like.
Yes.
Okay. Now, what was your specific job
for the entire period?
Well, let's try that.
Okay. Well, when I signed on with the troops in Corvallis, I was hired on as a forestry technician, which I stayed as a forestry technician. I retired as a forestry technician. And I must say, the wages and the benefits were wonderful. That's why I stayed so long. Just because I was paid very well for the job I did. I started out as a forestry tech in Corvallis, which we did a lot of insect work, more insect work in Corvallis than we did here. Laboratory work. We did a lot of the basic work for the Douglas Vertussock model in Oregon, Washington. One of our jobs there was to monitor the population levels of the tussock moth in Arizona, California, Oregon, Washington, and little parts of Canada. So that's what we did in Corvallis, essentially we did mostly insect work, field-oriented insect work.
Okay. When you came to Union County, did you have a choice in the matter? Was it a career move that brought you here? Was it an opportunity that brought you here?
Let's see. Okay. What caused me to come to Corvallis was that we were given the opportunity to come to La Grande. We were told that there was a similar job in La Grande, but the one I held in Corvallis had been eliminated. So we were working a lot out of La Grande. We were traveling from Corvallis to La Grande many times during the summer to work over here. So they decided they would transfer a lot of us over here so we'd be in residence here.
Okay.
So.
So now you were a forestry technician the entire career. So what was your specifically set to do when you came to La Grande?
Our job here, or my job, would have been to continue on. We were the Forest Service had evolved a little bit over the period of time where the responsibilities of different work units were specific insects. So when we were working in Corvallis, we were working with the Douglas fir tussock moth, and that meant we went all of these different places in the country looking at tussock moth. We got down to Arizona. We wherever the tussock moth, we went. And so we evolved over here to continue doing that work. It changed a little because some of the dynamics of the tussock moth had been already researched out. We've done all the research on it. We did work with the artificial pheromones. We did work with the rearing of the tussock moth. We did work with the virus. So we sort of got all the stuff published, and it is now in residence and publications.
So the tussock moth work didn't continue very long then after you came to La Grande?
It continued here for maybe 5-6 years. Mm-hmm. And then it evolved into other things. And we went to other insects. So then about that same time, the Western Spruce Budworm started up, and the epicenter there was in Cove. So we spent many, many years working with the Western Spruce Budworm in Oregon, in Washington.
Okay. For those who don't know, what is the significance of the Western Spruce Budworm especially to people in the county? Was it a hazard?
Well, it was a defoliator. It eats the needles of the host tree. So was it a hazard to Union County? It caused mortality of trees. It caused economic problems. It caused fire hazards. I assume that if your trees were defoliated, the value of your land went down. We did not research those things. We were research the biology of the critters, understanding what made them tick.
Okay. Now, what would your part be? What part would you play then in contributing to the understanding of this?
For the Western Spruce Budworm, a lot of my job responsibilities was in the summer. I would be responsible for the summer crew. We would hire on summer temporaries, most of which were college-age students that were working in biology. Mostly, we would almost always get somebody that was working in biology. So we had these people that were interested in the work, and they also wanted to run. So what did we do in the summer? We would go out and we would look at trees, and we would work with population dynamics, which meant looking to see how many insects the Western Spruce Budworm were actually infesting the trees, which these are models. What we were doing is we were making models, which were models that were made similar to the Douglas fir tussock moth. The Douglas fir tussock moth served as a model for the Spruce Budworm. And in fact, for years we did, two of our sampling systems were Douglas fir tussock moth and the Western Spruce Budworm sampling systems.
Okay, for those who don't know, what do you mean when you say you were working on a model?
The model for these were by collecting data, current data on population dynamics, I could the research unit could determine what the present condition was, what was going on in the woods, and using some other techniques, historical information, you could generate some stuff in the past. So if you know what's going on in the past and what's going on at the present time, you can make some predictions using a model of what might happen in the future.
Okay.
So out of those two things, there was a bunch of curves generated. So you could predict when a catastrophic or at least an event was going to happen with the Douglas fir tussock moth and the spruce budworm as the population dynamics arise.
So what would you do with that information then?
That information was published, and it was up to the general public to use it. It was made available to the Forest Service, and certainly as a Forest Service document, and the managers, mostly zone entomologists and pathologists, would use that information when they were asked to go into the forest to make some recommendations. They would have a tool available that they could use to ascertain their population dynamics.
Whose job would it be to formulate a response to, say, an epidemic of this insect
response
in the area?
Well, I would make the assumption that the forest would ask a zone entomologist to come and look at their problem. They could use the information that was available, the models, go out and ascertain what was out there. Then, as their responsibilities, they would write a prescription saying, this is what we think we should do.
Okay.
There's certain levels. It's at this level, at a lower level, don't do anything. It looks like it's climbing. You need to have information over a couple, 2 or 3 years to see what the population is doing. Also looking at parasites and predators, too. That's a great indicator of what's going on in the woods.
So. Okay. Let's talk about, let's get more specific then now. You had, you worked with a lot of, well, let's go back even further. What areas would these summer interns that you would accompany out to the field, what places in the region would you go to do your work in the summer?
Well, mostly it was Oregon and Washington. Mostly Oregon.
Right.
As the budgets crept down, as the research organization changed over time, and the mission was changed, our responsibilities changed a little bit, whereby when we first signed on, we were responsible for a group of people was responsible for the Douglas fir tussock moth. So they usually went to where the problem was, regardless of state boundaries. As the money and the research budgets got smaller and smaller, we were mostly responsible for Oregon and Washington. And we looked at Oregon and Washington. So mostly we would work out of La Grande, and we would take day trips and sometimes overnight trips to areas to look at these insects.
What areas, for example?
We had regular areas that we would look. We looked at all around this valley here. We spent, matter of fact, we have permanent sample plots here that have been in here for 30-some years in the Grand Ronde Valley. I mean, the Grand Ronde Valley and surrounding areas. So there's been an extreme example of long-term population dynamics here, which is probably not found very often in research. Certainly not anymore. Research has no intent to ever be in a long-term research project anymore. Long-term, maybe 2 or 3 years now. And in fact, when I retired, we were still doing it, and it will still be done by someone. Continue to take some information until they're no longer able to do that. So,
okay. What is a sample plot?
When we were sampling for these critters, we would go to an area that we had chosen for rhyme or reason, whether it was historic information that we knew that there was populations of these critters there. We could see them. We could see that the trees have been defoliated. That means that the needles have turned brown in the fall. Egg masses were found. Aerial surveys indicate that they thought that was western spruce budworm or the Douglas fir tussock moth. So we'd find these places, and we'd set up some permanent sample points. And we would we'd go to those places, and we would physically sample each of our sample trees, determine using our models again, by looking at how many critters we get off of a branch, what that really meant. And we would take information on parasites. Well, not parasites, not there, predators. We would collect predator information there. We would sometimes collect some of the critters to bring them back to the lab to rear for parasite information. Rear out the parasites here in the lab.
Okay.
So, and we do that in the valley here. We go down to Burns, John Day, up into Washington.
So then you would bring this material or information or sample back to the lab. What would happen then?
During that period of time, we would, if we were, depending on what we were doing, if we were rearing them just to see what kind of parasites was in, we didn't have to do anything. We would just put them in petri dishes. We collect them in petri dishes, and we just put them in rearing racks in an ambient laboratory temperature, and the parasites would eventually emerge out of the larvae, and we could identify those. If we were going to rear them through, we would make some artificial diet that had been researched. I don't know where that was done. I have no idea where the diet was generated, but we had some artificial diet we could make for the Western spruce budworm, and we could feed the larvae through that, and we could then rear them through adults, and then mate them, and then get egg masses, and do whatever we wanted to with egg masses.
Mm-hmm.
And that's usually sometimes a lot of people would say that the egg mass is a level of that's not the right word. How well the egg masses are doing. If the egg mass is a large or an average egg mass, you'd say the population is stable or growing. If it's starting to look stressed or something, the number of eggs would be reduced.
Okay.
So you can get some information that way. And also you can, just for stock, you could rear for stock, have a good supply of critters.
Okay. What other things were you involved with? We've talked about your involvement with summer interns and collecting information in the area. What other sorts of duties did you have here in La Grande?
Well, after we got over here, we started doing a lot of dendrochronology work, which probably took 10 years, maybe 10 or 12 years.
And what is dendrochronology?
Dendrochronology is a study of tree rings.
Okay.
So we did a lot of that. These things are married into one another. You can tell a lot about what's happening to a tree by looking at its past. That's where some of these models can... A story that is associated with dendrochronology. If I know something about what's going on right now to a tree, and if it has been infested with a defoliator that I'm studying, I can relate that to certain types of reactions to the tree ring growth, and I can set up patterns, and I can then use some other type of trees. Usually we use ponderosa pine as a control, and I can eliminate in the models and computer models, I can eliminate the effect of weather, and what's left is the effect of the insect. So this is another place where you can get these. If I know what's happening now, I can look at the past, and then I can make some predictions of the future. So, by looking at the tree rings are a very fascinating study.
Can you determine other events or situations that might have taken place besides weather or insect?
If you know the event, there's indicator rings. What they call indicator rings I think in 1949. There was a drought. Anyhow, 1949, I believe, was an indicator ring in lodgepole pine. So if you find a lodgepole pine, you go back and you core it, and you go back and look at 1949, you'll notice that there's a very small ring. So you can use those weather, you can look for indicator rings that say this is an event that happened. So you know whether or not your work is accurate. You can use those to check the accuracy of your work.
Okay. But are there other, disaster events besides weather or...
Well, there'd be fire.
Okay.
You can see the effects of fire.
Earthquake or flood may be determined or...
Not that I know of.
Okay, okay.
No. It's anything that affects the growth of the tree.
The tree itself. Yeah,
okay. If it's put under tremendous stress by something, it'll reflect in the tree rings, and it reflects on competition too. If you notice, if you ever seen some tree rings, you'll notice that young trees all have smaller rings because they're competing with one another. And then as they go through and thin them out, it releases the tree, and the rings will spring up very large.
Because there isn't as much competition.
Yeah, because they're standing out there in the sun.
Okay. Okay.
So there's competition when they're young. Release them. I can grow trees real fast if I cut down a lot of trees around.
Okay. What else have you done? Yeah. What other projects?
Well, the tree rings took a lot of time. We did. We should talk a little bit about what else we do with those tree rings. We did a lot of stuff with the University of Arizona and the tree ring laboratory down there as co-op studies. They were interested in making models of certain species of trees, ponderosa pines. So lots of times we were out in the woods looking for very large ponderosa pine. We did this a lot of this in the wilderness areas here, in Tucanyon. Wanaha Tucanyon.
You mean where people don't ordinarily congregate?
Well, it's because there's no forestry practices there. There's no...
Okay.
They do not put fires out. They do not log in there. So what you see there is pretty close to what might have been if man hadn't influenced us. Obviously. The influence of humans is minimal there. So we did a lot of work for them, looking for big pines, coring big trees. And it takes a lot of time to... A lot of laboratory time to work on tree rings.
Let's look at some of the specifics then. So you go to the wilderness and you look for the largest of the ponderosa pine that you can find.
Mm-hmm.
Then how do you sample that tree? Do you actually take the tree down or can you sample it without damaging it?
We drill. Have you ever seen the drills?
No.
Okay. Well,
and our audience probably
hasn't either. It's an increment bore. It takes like a 3/16 inch core out of the tree. So the standards are that one would take a core 4.5 feet from the ground in two different directions, perpendicular to one another. So if the core is this long, 24 inches or so, you have a bore that will go in 24 inches and takes out a core. And then that's put into a straw or something to bring back to the lab and it's mounted. So the statistical programs that run these will look at the two cores and they'll average those cores and they'll tell you some things about how well you did or how well you measured them and where some problems might be. And that's where
that's where those samples came from.
Right, right.
Okay.
Those were important. We did a lot of other work in that. When we went into the wilderness, we were doing lots of other things. We were sampling for the tussock moth and for the budworm. We were also be looking at for big trees too. There are certain criteria that they needed for these big trees.
Mm-hmm. What were some of those?
First off, the biggest tree you could find.
Okay.
And not particularly near a water course where they were. Their feet were wet all the time. You know, you want to keep them away from the riparian zone. So they were more typical rather than a tree that had all the water it could possibly use.
Okay. Did you supervise people who did this, or were you actively participating with them to actually get the work done, sampling?
Or? Oh, yes. I usually supervised the summer crews when we had big summer crews. Mm-hmm. As time evolved, the Forest Service, we had less and less summer crews. I think our biggest crew we had at one time was we had three people working in the tree ring lab. We had a regular tree ring, a dendrochronology lab here, and we had three people that worked in there full time. So doing tree ring analysis. So that's probably our biggest crew. Our summer crew usually involved one or two summer employees. And the scientists. It was mostly, for the last few years, it was just the scientists and myself working with some of this.
You mean most recently?
Most recently,
okay.
The last few years. The last 6 years or so.
Well, let's talk about other projects. What else would you have been actively involved in? It does not sound like a 9-to-5 job where you do a particular set of tasks in repetition Monday
Yeah, research people are have traditionally been different and they not really align too well with the regular Forest Service, the district disciplines. So in the past it was more of an academic type atmosphere where scientists were free to pursue basic research, where they weren't constrained by whatever drives the research. I know many times we'd be out in the woods and say, geez, I want to be Wouldn't it be interesting if we figured out what happened here and what caused this problem? And we could just go the next day and we could start doing that. Now you can't do that. It all has to be written into a plan of what you're going to do and how long you're going to do it and how much it's going to cost. So the difference between, at least what I've seen, are the Forest Service, is there's the district people, the research people. They all got their paycheck from the same place, but they all react different and they work different. Yeah. Certainly we did not have things we did the same every day and every day. There's always something a little bit different. There's some monotony, of course, but, and then there was also the pressure of getting the job done before the snow fell or before Melbourne, whatever we was doing.
Mm-hmm. So, were there any other significant projects then that you would be out working on? We've talked about the moth and...
Well, yeah, we did the moths, we did the dendrochronology stuff, and then when Jane Hayes showed up, we started to work with DNA and chemicals. So that's the last 6 or so years we did DNA and chemical stuff.
Now, how does that contribute to the big picture? I know you're not the research scientist on that, but you must have some knowledge of how that...
What, you mean the DNA?
The DNA or the chemical analysis?
Well, there was two different things. We're talking about two different things. DNA would have been just some basic research to determine if certain populations were the same or they're in fact different, which was something that's interesting. Is a beetle that you find in, of the same species you find in Arizona or Mexico, is it the same species that we have in Oregon, genetically?
Mm-hmm.
Are they all genetically the same, or are they just a little bit different? Are there different genetic variations? So that was one of the big studies Jane is still working on, the variations of beetles throughout the Americas, from Canada to southern Mexico. The chemical thing was adjusting populations by using chemicals, either trapping them out, or you put chemicals out and you attract insects into a trap where they eventually are dead, or you modify their behavior and make them go away from you. So.
Well, let's talk about each of those. let's talk about chemicals that would drive them out.
There's been studies done on certain chemicals that will, the one that we use was verbenone, and it was an anti-aggregant. And if I had some property that was infested with beetles, and beetles cannot be controlled in the traditional way of larvae or something that's on the outside of the tree. The beetles are inside and under the bark. So you need to influence them in a different way. So you have some high value stuff. Right now, verbenone is too expensive to use throughout the forest. So you can put verbenone out and try to protect your property. Now,
are we talking in this case an individual landowner?
An individual landowner could do it, mm-hmm. but for the most part, it's the U.S. Forest Service trying to save some pristine forest.
Right.
Trying to control save some really nice trees. That's what they were doing in the Naha, trying to save some nice trees down by the Naha River.
Okay. Now, when we talk about an anti-aggregant, we're talking about a chemical that outright they don't like, and so they're not going to hang in the area? Is that
they're
what you mean?
They're going to
go elsewhere?
They're going to move away from that area.
Okay. Then, go ahead.
All right. These are research projects. Remember, these are products that you can buy commercially. They're over, and research is laid over that, and you're trying to find out what's the minimum amount of chemicals you can use to effectively produce this. And is there an effect? In fact, if I put verbenone out, can I drive them away, or is something else driving them away, or did I have any effect at all? So there's all kinds of things. So it depends on the dosage too.
Okay. What about the chemicals that attract them in then?
Well, chemicals, those are artificial pheromones, or pheromones that are produced chemically, that attract insects to a trap. The insect will, through their physiology, think that this is a tree,
uh-huh.
and I'm going to come attack this tree. And lo and behold, it's something else. And you can trap them out. There are a lot of critters out there.
is that effective? Should say, was the study, did they determine it was effective?
You can trap out insects. You have to, you know, but I think they're still determining, if I trap out 2 million insects, does that mean that there's 100 billion of them out there still? No. They don't know what that is. They don't know.
Okay.
You can try to reduce the load. Mm-hmm. You know, influence some stuff. And maybe lower, it's possible you might be able to lower the population until some predators come in. Parasites and predators come in. Parasite and predators are the biggest controlling unit of those. They come a year or two later. As the population of one critter increases, parasites and predators will come in, and their population will increase to match the host critter, and they will come in and eventually control that, and then they'll both drop down.
Okay.
So just a bell curve effect.
But it's actually an ongoing study still.
They're always ongoing.
Okay.
But most of the stuff has been published. At least all the stuff on the Douglas fir tussock moth has been published. I haven't seen anything new in tussock moth for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Dendrochronology stuff is, everybody studies dendrochronology. One nice thing about dendrochronology is that you can, on certain...
We're continuing the interview with Gene Paul. It is still February 14th, 2006. And before the tape ended, we were talking about the in the Denver chronology that the information could go into a bank, and
it was put into a big data bank, and then other people can pull information out of that. If someone wanted to say, what does an average ponderosa pine in eastern Oregon look like, they could pull that information off of the computer database.
Okay.
So other people don't have to do this. So the idea was that you only need to do it once. You don't have to invent the wheel every time you go out in the woods.
Okay, makes sense to me. Let's see, what other projects have you worked on?
That's about it. I did some stuff for NOAA. Acid range.
NOAA, you mean?
Yeah,
NOAA?
National Oceanic and
Atmospheric
Science
Administration.
Yes. Mm-hmm. A long time ago, 1982 or so, NOAA established a whole bunch of acid rain reporting stations across the country. Essentially, they were looking for acid rain. And the Starkey Station was selected as a site. And we collected data there once a week, did the chemical analysis on that, and sent it back to their database. And that still continued now. There's still people at Starkey who do that now.
What does that consist of? Is that like collecting rain? Do you collect it out of the air?
It has what they're looking right now is, gosh, it's been so long. They have a rain gauge that looks at precipitation. So when I'm having a rain event, there's a cover over the bucket. It's actually a bucket. There's a cover over the bucket. When a sensor feels rain, it opens the top of the bucket. Moves a lid off of the bucket. It collects the rain. When there's no longer any precipitation on the sensor, it shuts itself down. So there's a temperature is recorded, I believe, but also the rain event is also recorded. So you can look at the chart, and you can tell when the gauge is open and how much. Then you can calibrate how much rain on each event, as far as precipitation. And that is brought back to the lab, and pH and conductivity readings are made in the field. Those samples are then sent back to University of Illinois, and then they're reanalyzed back there, and part of that sample is large enough, the aliquot is saved for, I guess, forever. So they have records of precipitation here in Houston. So I believe there's well over 200 sites. Every Tuesday morning, someone's out there doing this analysis.
So the precipitation that falls in the bucket stays in the bucket, and they actually, that's their lab sample then?
Right,
when
the bucket is empty, changed.
Uh-huh.
So,
every Tuesday?
Every Tuesday. So,
mm-hmm.
So they're looking at acid rain.
Does that, do they do the same study if it snows rather than rains?
Yes.
Or sleet or hail or whatever.
Year round. It's, mm-hmm. it's every. It the equipment was as I remember right was engineered and developed for southern climates. They have a hard time modifying it for snow events. It lags behind. I mean by lags, it means that you don't get as much precipitation as you think you get because of the snow. There's this problem with the amount of snow that comes in. Snow, it doesn't open up as fast. The lid doesn't capture all the precipitation that's coming down.
But the sensors can tell the difference between rain and snow and hail or snow?
No. The sensor is just a sensor that when any precipitation falls on there, it melts it. It says it forms a circuit, opens up the top. There's a heater in there. When there's no more additional precipitation added to that sensor, it dries itself off and closes the top of it.
I see.
So.
Okay. So that's the precipitation study for NOAA. Were there other gadgets or equipment that
they did? When was it? They're doing some particulate stuff that they did in the last few years. They started doing particulate. They had some filters out there. They were looking for events.
What do you mean by particulate?
Stuff that's floating in the air, solids that you could pick up without a rain event. It was just a big filter. They're using filters and collecting this. I was not familiar with that. So, but anyhow, they looked at all kinds of the analysis back at the University of Illinois was quite elaborate. And they would publish this stuff for us once a year and we could look at it. They'd also check on us. There was many, many tests performed on these people to see if the quality of work was done.
I see. Is it a tech that goes out every Tuesday and collects this, or is it a scientist?
Oh, it's just a tech, yes.
Uh-huh. And so I guess contributing the big picture, how many other techs are there in the building or in this lab then that are techs versus scientists?
Golly, there aren't that many anymore.
Uh-huh.
Four or five or something like that right now.
Okay.
There never was that many. There used to be a lot more. We used to have a lot more technicians, but they sometimes go to term employment, hire somebody for a term. Some are employees that are actually looking for a way to get on with the government. We've had volunteers work for the workforce as volunteers, no pay. But mostly people that are interested. When we hired somebody, we always looked for somebody that was interested in the sciences, biology. We usually get biology or some sort of a science background.
Mm-hmm.
Some kind of outstanding people workforce.
Let's get to the Starkey Project. First of all, what is the Starkey Project? What does that consist of in a nutshell?
You're going to have to go to a much larger person than I to get this stuff. The way I understand it, the Starkey Project was initiated, 10, 12, 13, 14 years ago, as a place to study the behavior of elk, ungulates. And they got the funding to build a large fence with several subunits in there that they could study the behavior of elk and deer and cattle. So once the fence was up, they could put collars on the deer, the elk, and the cattle, and watch their behavior.
Now, are we talking about, when you say that, are talking about a control group that always stay in this particular area?
Well, there's controls, but I think that the animals are not. They're different animals yearly, I think.
Okay.
And they don't follow the life cycle of one critter, and there's multiple. Research projects going on out there all the time, but that was the original attempt. And there's what I mean is they track them. They track them with a modified. They're using GPS now. They're moving to put all new units out there as GPS. The other one was was done with triangulations with towers. There's several towers out of Starkey, and they were using those to triangulate the movements of the critters. An interesting story, this happened a long time ago. Was, gosh, how many years ago? I don't know. A whole bunch of years. They had too many elk out there, and they were going to have a special hunt at Starkey. And one of the conditions was that the hunters would have to carry one of these, essentially a collar-like device on them in a backpack. And they could, then the researchers could follow the hunter and how the hunter affected the population, or the movement of the elk inside that fence. And as I remember right, if you wanted to, you could stop at the Starkey headquarters and you left, and you could, they would run the tape for you and they would show you where you were at and location to where the rest of the elk herd was. And it was very, very interesting because people were generally right in with the elk and they didn't know it. The elk was moving around them. So it was an interesting story. I think some of the people didn't like to know that they weren't that good of a hunter.
Some of those people probably wish that they could have seen that in advance.
Well, yeah, you know, it was just a condition of the hunt, though. But,
sure.
But the elk certainly did respond to uh-huh. to the pressure of people.
Now, when you talk about we track the these animals now by GPS, what was done earlier? Was it radio collar?
There were radio collars, said, yeah. They're using the towers. Have you seen the towers out of Starkey?
I have not actually been there.
Starkey has, six, maybe nine large towers. They range from about 90 to 140 feet tall. Gosh, that's something else I did. We should talk about that.
Okay.
And they use that to monitor. I'm not the person to talk about Starkey. I worked at Starkey a lot. I was, as I told you last week, I was there when the first post went down in the Starkey unit for the fence. But one of the other projects that we did, we spent for about four years on this, is I went out to Starkey and I used these same towers, and that's why I know the height of them, is that we had ropes put on these towers, adjacent to the towers, and they run from, I think, 90 to 140 feet. And I could put traps on these towers with sticky material on them, and I'd raise these traps at 10-meter intervals. So on some of the towers, I have six traps, some more or less. And then I would fly those traps for a week at a time, and I could tell what kind of critters were flying out there in the woods at 10-meter intervals, where the insects, how the insects were flying through the atmosphere, or the population and the density.
Anything interesting come out of that?
Other than most of the insects stay real close to the ground, very seldom. The only thing we get up high was stuff that was influenced by the wind. The wind was generating their desires, not themselves. So
insects don't normally fly 140 feet in the air?
At that point of time, no. Not at all. And these critters are worth looking at.
Uh-huh.
And, it was very interesting. It was usually very windy. And if you ever did anything with rope, you know that say you had 140, 150 feet of rope, that's 300 feet of rope hanging off of a tower. Lots of times you couldn't hold on to that. We had, we started out about 90 pounds of concrete at the bottom to hold the rope down. And on a good windy day, it would pick up a 90-pound piece of concrete and move it around.
Huh.
So we had to add more concrete to it. We had to use some very sophisticated knots and reefing to hold it up. It's amazing how much wind resistance a rope puts on.
How big is the area that the Starkey project is in?
Yeah, you're going to have somebody else.
Okay.
It's a large area, yeah. But it's part of the Starkey Experimental Forest, which is managed by PNW and the local forest.
Okay.
But as far as square acres or square miles, I couldn't tell you.
But it's pretty large.
It's a wonderful research area.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the towers then. What do you know, or what about these towers there?
You mean from our perspective, for those?
What are the purpose of the towers?
Well, they were the original purpose of the towers was to track the animals, the elk. So there was towers put out there, so the entire research area was covered by a tower, so they could pick up the radio signals and they could triangulate to determine the physical location of those critters.
Mm-hmm. Were they monitored year-round?
Yes, year-round. In the wintertime, I don't think so. I think they eventually take the collars off in the wintertime. And they collar the young calves in the springtime. They put collars on them, and then I think they trap what they want, you know, from other species, I mean, other age groups. So they want yearlings or something like that. They go out and trap those.
Were you involved with any of the collaring projects?
No. I wrangled some cows once, and that was it.
Who works on collaring projects? Is that a technician? Do they contract that out? What are they?
The unit here, the people that work for Starkey. There's probably a group of about five people now. That's their entire job, is to work on the Starkey unit, and they're responsible for the maintenance of the fence, capturing the animals, collecting the research, and eventually publishing the data. And there's also people from the ODF&W work out there too. A lot of cooperators. There's the people that come in. They built a bunkhouse type facility here just recently, a real nice one. So they can accommodate summer employees or PhD candidates and stuff like that, or visiting scientists, or whatever they want.
When those towers were monitored in the summer or the spring, say, was somebody up there all the time then?
You mean for the insect stuff?
Insects or elk or
whatever? Well, the elk stuff is that information is transmitted to a base station up there. So that, yes, they have people that watch that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Or monitor. But it's stuff that can be put on, I assume it was on tape at that time.
Oh, actually, so this is equipment relay that's happening.
Right.
It's not actually a person has to.
Oh, no. The towers are like TV towers. These are very, very large TV towers.
Oh, they're not human towers.
No, they're
watch
not.
Watch towers.
No, they have microwave repeaters and stuff like that.
Okay, all right.
So they're looking at electronic signals and monitoring those, and those signals are then pushed down to the computers.
Mm-hmm. Anything else that you worked on or did up at Starkey Project up there?
No. Oh, we messed around with some small projects. The one that did you work on that?
Well, I completed, we're working on the...
sweep net stuff. There were some sweep nets.
Yeah.
There's some stuff up there. These are just auxiliary studies to help supplement some research about what critters might be up there. Our involvement would only been in the insect dynamics of what population dynamics of what critters might be up there. So we did some sweep net stuff and controlled and uncontrolled stuff. And
mm-hmm.
We've done some work on thinned and unthinned up there. We did some fire stuff. Did some DNA analysis of critters, but it was an easy place to get DNA. Out of Starkey. Starkey is a wonderful place to work because that's what it was set up for, is for research.
Okay. What things would you work on then when you weren't out in the field? What would keep you busy working here in the lab?
Well, as part of my job?
Yeah.
Well, a day or two in the woods can generate many weeks of laboratory work. When we were doing tree ring analysis, we would we could collect probably 90 cores a day, and that would probably interpret to maybe 2 hours a core, 2.5 hours core in the lab. Yeah, so it. Almost any research project you do, you can go out and generate a whole bunch of lab work in a hurry. So when we were doing lots of this stuff, the winter time and the fall time would be consumed with doing backlog of data analysis, or actually lab work.
Okay. So your duties were all encompassing then. You'd go out on behalf of these study projects and collect those samples and then continue by working on them when you got back home.
Yes. Mm-hmm. My job description, that's what my job description said, that I was responsible for collecting, or assisting in collecting and processing, and evolved at times to publish that data. So I published some data. I forget. I got gee, for a technician, I did pretty good. I think I got 4, 5, 6 publications as I was a senior author, and maybe another 15 or 20 that I was a second author.
Is that typical for a forestry technician to get published?
No, not too often. Not anymore. I don't know. I think that's atypical. I think I was very fortunate to publish quite a bit of stuff.
How would that come about? Or I should say, maybe, how did that come about that you got published? That was it because you were...
Well, it was assigned a task, and it just generated that some of the stuff that came out was worthwhile. Some of the stuff I did was equipment development. I'd done some publishing on that. And a lot of the stuff was on the Tussock mill, techniques, data stuff like that. Just, I don't know how it evolved. It was just there, and we did it. And the person that did the most work is usually the senior author who knows the most about it. So, at least in my case, it was.
Yeah. So, any other work or projects you do, either in-house or out in the field, in the course of your...
No, that was just about it. I think about things. We've done a lot of little things, but mostly we did some... we did a lot of work down at Klamath Falls, but that was mostly on the Tussock Mill. We traveled around. That was during the period where we were traveling a lot. We'd travel every week. That was about it. Those were the big things I did for 4 years.
How long total did you spend with the Forest Service?
My retirement paper says 40.1 years. So I don't know what the .1 is. That's a hundredth of a year, I guess, or a tenth of a year.
Tenth of a year. How'd you get into it?
Into forestry?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I just had an interest in forestry. I was able to, through school, to get my summer jobs, and I worked in the summer jobs. It had nothing to do with what I do now, but I got in for 2 years as a summer employee, and I applied for a job out here. Eventually I got the job, and when I started working for the PNW in Corvallis, there was only 3 of us there. And there must be 120 there now.
Did you go to college?
I went to private college for 2 years. I went to Iowa State for a year. I went to Oregon State. I went to Benton Community College. That's it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a degree that got you the job? Or
no, it didn't get me the job.
Uh-huh.
But I did get a lot of training. I had some very wonderful opportunities to the Forest Service provided for me to go for training. An aside, you wanted an aside.
Sure.
Here's one. In Corvallis, I was part of my responsibilities was an insect museum, for the lack of a better term, a pseudo curator of the museum. I was collecting insects and sending them back to the National Museum for identification. If we couldn't identify them locally with the taxonomists there, we'd send them back to the National Museum for identification. At that time, I was taking a forest entomology class at the university, and I knew the instructor. He was a very well-known instructor, and I also knew the TA. Was having trouble with the lab final, and he came over and asked me if I could provide him with some insects for the lab final in the class that I was taking. So needless to say, I got a real good grade on the lab final because I provided all the specimens for identification.
Uh-huh.
So.
Have you discovered any insects that'll have your name on it?
Not my name, but insects are usually... Names and nomenclature for insect names have changed over the past. And lots of times when people found a new insect or they thought they found a new insect, they would name it after their child or the color of the sky that day or something, and which didn't make much sense. And over the last 20 or so years, they're going back and renaming insects to make them more sensible names for them. They've changed the names. So. But now what they do is if they find a new insect, and it's a unique insect, and they find out that it's never been identified, they will name it after the person that originally did the work on it. Not the taxonomist that wrote up the taxonomical differences on it, but the actual researcher that worked on the critter, discovered the critter. So the only one that I know of, there was a fellow here named Dick Mason, and he has a critter named after him, and it's it's Masoni.
What kind of a critter is it?
It's a parasite of a Douglas fir tussock moth. The formal name is Hypersoter Masoni. So that's how you get an insect named after you. So you have to do the research.
You can't just find it in your backyard anymore.
It depends where your backyard is. I guess there's a place down south, of course.
Uh-huh.
Last week they found a place that has all these critters that haven't been identified.
Reading about that.
Yeah, so there's going to be a whole bunch of critters down there.
Uh-huh. Well, that's very interesting. Let's talk about your involvement now with the Red Cross. We actually had some contact together in the past because I used to chair the Red Cross Board over in Umatilla County, and Umatilla and Union County were kind of doing some strategic collaborating for a while. How long have you been involved with the Red Cross here?
In Union County since about 1981, as soon as I got here. So,
have you been involved with Red Cross in other areas besides here?
Corvallis.
Okay. What's your involvement with Red Cross right now? Are you on the board?
I'm not on the board. I used to be on the board. I'm a volunteer. I have several honorary positions because I'm a volunteer. I'm an instructor trainer. That means I train instructors to go out in the community and teach first aid and CPR. I teach first aid and CPR. I teach most of the disaster classes in Union County, and that's about it. Yeah, that's most of my responsibilities there.
What are the requirements to be a disaster responder with the Red Cross? What classes or training do they go through?
Well, it's evolved over the past few years. They try to get people, the local people, you probably know this, to respond to national emergencies. They get them trained up. So during the Katrina flood, we trained up 63 people to go down there within about 2 weeks' notice. So we had classes so they at least knew what they were getting into and what to expect down there. We're now many people don't have the opportunity to go to national disasters. So we're sort of evolving into training people locally to take care of the disasters locally and still have some expertise on them. We have mini drills. We have just drills last month, a big drill, where we were to provide assistance for 250 families here in Union County due to a snow problem. So we're always training people for disasters.
Now, you did this disaster training. Who evaluated that training? Who decides whether that training is effective or not?
It's usually a representative from the National Red Cross, regional and or national, has an observer, or they're part of the team that comes in and provides us with the problems to solve.
Now, that was a planned mock disaster. Do you ever have unplanned disasters to test your people out?
Mostly we have snow problems. I guess we had a flood. You know, that's flood. Our disaster response is for basically for wintertime problems. We respond to fires, single family fires. We would respond to floods and forest fires if we were asked. And our response there would be to open up kitchens and places to sleep, stuff like that. And we have limited resources. We could assist the clients in some of these problems.
Do you think that Union County is well prepared in this area for disaster response? What's your interpretation of that?
Yeah, we certainly are. We potentially could house. We have 1,000 cots. And we have potentially about 800 spaces in the Grand Ronde Valley where we could put up to 800 people, I think. That does not include the two largest facilities that we haven't tapped, the Armory and or the University. If we were to tap those, we could far exceed them.
Have there been any disasters locally in the last 5 years that you've had to pull out a team for in the Union County area?
Well, we've had snow disasters. And that means either A, opening up facilities to warm people up and or put them up for the night.
What's the definition of a snow disaster?
Here is when the interstate is closed and the motels are full.
Okay.
Or mostly full. When those two conditions happen, then we will be notified and we will open up a shelter. And those people can come in and we will provide them with a place to sleep and food.
How do people know to come to the Red Cross when that happens?
How do they know? Well, hopefully we have people out there telling them. The radio is telling them. The people that are stopping them from going where they want to go are telling them. The word of mouth. Mostly, I think what happens a lot of times is when the motels get full. When they no longer can provide shelter or the people can't afford it, they'll say, there's been a shelter's opened up. And we've actually, in times, we've taken Jock's copies of the maps and gone out to the intercept and given them out to people waiting out there. They know.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Did any of the Union County Red Cross volunteers respond to the disaster at 911 in 2001?
I have to speak for the chapter. Well, I can speak for the Union County too. Union County sent a psychologist and a couple nurses. There was a policeman from Baker that went. So we did provide. Per capita, we always do really well. We're a very, very small chapter, and our volunteer percentages are just great. So,
does the chapter make up more than Union County?
Baker County.
Union and Baker Union County Baker. Are in this chapter of the Red Cross. How well off are they financially? Are they getting, are people continuing to donate time or money to the cause?
Well, it fluctuates.
Sure.
Certainly after the floods, we had more volunteers than we could train. As a result of that, we have a lot of people that are continuing to volunteer for the Red Cross. They want to continue to be trained and to work locally. Financially, we are always struggling to find funds.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably the smallest.